Hello, and welcome to TN Biscuits with Misha,
Bobby, and today we have a guest, a very good friend of ours. Introduce yourself, please.
Hi, guys. I'm Fraser.
Yeah.
Yep. Right. And today, because last time we really enjoyed it, we're doing the same thing of each of us has something fun that the others know basically nothing about, and we're just going to chat about it. So, who's starting?
I think you can start with Rudolf Hess. I'll go second, and Fraser, do you want to go last?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay.
Right. I actually prepared a bit more than I ever did for a Tea and Biscuits episode, so this should be interesting. So, who was Rudolf Hess? Does the name ring a bell to either of you?
I know who he is, but you might not know, Fraser.
No, I've only ever heard of something called the Hessian, but I don't know if it's related.
No, that would be a mathematician. This guy was the deputy Führer of the Nazi Party from 1933 to 1941. And, I mean, he was a very weird guy, and I'll get into a bit of that because it's relevant here. But the main thing I want to focus on is his flight to England on the 10th of May in 1941. Because it stands unmatched as one of the weirdest and most inexplicable events in modern history. So, on the face of it, a guy who was the second most important man in Germany sneaks under cover of darkness to a field air station a couple dozen of kilometers outside Berlin, hijacks a plane, a fighter jet, mind you, and flies it across Germany, across bits of France, across the English Channel, veering clear of English anti-aircraft missiles, and into Scotland. Mind you, I'll re-emphasize that. He, being an extremely important and influential political figure, flies the plane himself, being an ex-World War I pilot.
And he lands, I guess, at an RAF base in Scotland?
Mm-hmm. He doesn't land. He's shot down by three English planes. I think they were Spitfires. Parachutes, breaks his leg, survives the landing into Scotland. Gets captured under a fake name, saying that he is Fritz something, and that he urgently needs to speak to Lord Halifax, who was a very important lord in Scotland and essentially the foreign minister of England at the time. Obviously, he is not taken to Lord Halifax, because why would a random soldier be taken to Halifax? He's taken to some Secret Service agents. And then he says, "Oh, hi! By the way, I'm Rudolf Hess, guy you saw on TV a couple of days ago. And I'm here to broker a peace deal with England." So far, weird.
Yeah, and it's also weird that I've never heard of it, like literally no mention of it in, because we took history and there's nothing mentioned about this.
True. To be honest, I don't know why it wasn't in our course. It seems like it would be important.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the weirdest part is that he didn't go there with the government's or Hitler's consent, so he had no authority to broker a peace deal.
Hmm.
So,
even if they would have taken him, even if they would have taken him seriously, he couldn't have achieved his goal.
Exactly, yeah. Even if his proposed deal, which the proposed deal was a pretty dumb one, it was, okay, Germans do whatever we want in Europe, but we won't attack Vichy France, and England stays out of it.
Hmm.
It's a pretty mid deal.
Yeah.
Wouldn't take that. Would you make that
deal? No.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of what they wanted to do at the beginning, no? That was the, like, appeasement was, yeah, we'll just let true. Nazi Germany take, do what they want, and we won't get involved.
It was a mistake.
Yeah, the concession, I suppose, was that they won't take the third of France that they haven't yet taken.
Okay, well. Thanks.
Not a big concession since they couldn't take it anyway. It was too much.
Exactly.
Actually, I'm right now reading Albert Speer's memoirs, who was Hitler's favorite architect. And he was actually in the room when Hitler got the letter from Hess. So Hess sent a letter to Hitler as he was disappearing to be delivered when he was mid-flight. And apparently the guy was jumping up and down with rage and saying that Hess needs to be executed. So it was definitely not pre-planned.
I can hear him doing that in my head.
Yeah, it's very in character, no?
Ein Verräter der deutschen Volk. Like in fucking, what was it? Downfall. I really want to watch Downfall.
I haven't watched Downfall either. We need to make a movie night out of that.
Have you seen Downfall?
I haven't heard of it either. I don't think.
Oh, shit. It's famous...
It's a movie of Hitler's last couple of days, right?
Yeah, it's a really famous scene.
Is it not the one we watched in history class? There was one we watched... Maybe my parents have seen it, actually. I think I've seen something. We watched something... Maybe I'm mixing it up, but maybe my parents have seen it.
He's just confused.
We did watch a movie in the dramatized, maybe not, sorry, not the end of his life, but I think around when he took control. We watched it in class. I remember,
that rings a bell, but that was more of a documentary. I think Downfall is more of a dramatized actual movie.
Okay. Yeah, Downfall is like, it's, I haven't seen it, but I've like watched like a brief review on Downfall. It's more of a film trying to, not humanize Hitler, but kind of show him for... Okay, I will, in my opinion, I will say humanize, because it like displays a lot of aspects of like daily bureaucratic life, and that famous scene in the bunker where he's yelling the heads off his generals. There's this really like a prominent scene where he's like sat, you know, crouching over the table, looking extremely small, and they mentioned that, the great Führer of Germany is just a broken, broken,
yeah, like
unhealthy.
Kind of obviously he wasn't a god, but a lot of people looked at him as like a force, like a god, and sort of take that away.
They really deified him, and they portrayed him as a broken.
I mean, in his
man.
Last couple of days, he apparently did some crazy stuff. Fired Goering, fired Himmler, actually called for both of them to be executed, appointed random school children who were guarding his bunker as the new air marshal and the new head of the SS.
Yeah.
But
what was
going crazier than before. Yeah, so back to Hess. In case anyone was curious, I'll say how the story ends. It ends with him getting going on trial in Nuremberg after World War II and getting a life sentence. Which, to me, seems unfair, especially compared to the other defendants. So he was captured in 1941, before the Holocaust, before war with Russia. Actually, that's one of the theories for why he flew, because he really didn't want to go to war with Russia.
Understandable.
Yeah.
Understandable. Eastern Front as hell.
And like, in comparison, Donitz... The guy who commanded the German Navy throughout the whole war got 10 years. This guy got a life sentence.
Was there any reasoning? Do you know if there was like... I don't exactly know how the Nuremberg trials worked, but do they say like, because he did this or...
Essentially, he got... he wasn't found guilty of crimes against humanities, which translating into normal language means he had no crimes related to the Holocaust.
Uh-huh.
But he was guilty of crimes against peace. So essentially starting the war.
Okay. But I'm sure then the other guy as well, the leader of the Navy, would have also gotten the same.
Yep. But he got a very different sentence, which if I were to hazard a guess as to why, it's because he was the guy who actually signed the surrender of Germany. So there must have been an under the table deal involved somewhere.
Okay. Well, possibly. Yeah.
I know about the trials of a couple of other head Nazis. Like Goering never actually made it to the end of his trial. He died by cyanide pill.
Was he not the one?
A bit confused there. He got to the very end of his trial. He was found guilty. He was sentenced to death. And a couple hours before he was supposed to be executed, he died by cyanide.
I know it was. I think it was Goebbels, maybe, who I think committed suicide before they even lost. And I remember I heard that he'd also killed like all of his pets. his kids. Mm-hmm. He was just like, yeah, if they're not living in Nazi Germany, it's over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, his six kids, and his wife was in on it.
So yeah,
she that was
it's actually nuts. Really interesting. I read about Goebbels' last day, and because he died 24 hours after Hitler. And for 24 hours, he was head of Germany, and he just desperately tried to surrender conditionally, so not complete surrender. That failed, and he said, oh, well, time to die.
So he was trying to cut the deal, and when it didn't work out, he was like, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm,
interesting.
Okay. Right. And going back to Hess, the more you think about it, the less logical it seems. The guy had nothing to gain and everything to lose. He was incredibly wealthy, incredibly powerful. Hitler did start being annoyed with him. The reason Hitler started being annoyed with him is actually really funny. It's because he brought pack lunches to their fancy dinners.
Yeah. That's kind of cute.
Mm-hmm. Because he had a very weird dietary belief. He was, I have it written down here, he followed a biodynamical diet. So only strict vegan and only eating food that was planted in the right cycle of the horoscope and with special crystals buried in the ground.
Sounds logical.
Sounds very crystal mom to me.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But what was like,
my best theory right now for why he did that fight is because he genuinely went crazy. I cannot think of any better reason.
What was
can you guys?
Yeah, I was just going to ask. Well, I don't know exactly what the timeline was, but so you said he left in 41 to Scotland.
Yeah.
So from
in
that
early 41.
Okay, so that had been 39, 40. So in that time, it was just in quotation marks. Obviously, it's still a war, but it was just like World War One in that sense, because the Holocaust was what differentiated it, I'm guessing.
Right. It was just another big European war. There wasn't anything particularly bad about it on the German side, except that they started it.
Yeah. Like, in 41, it was straight up war in 41. But I don't think World War II had achieved that status of English awfulness.
It was essentially a relatively localized European war in that sense. The African campaign hasn't really come into full swing back then. Russia has not been invaded. It was just France, Benelux, and Germany.
And with and Poland.
Poland and Poland, the rest of those.
Yeah, I guess that kind of makes your point more like you saying that you don't see why he did it because he had nothing to gain. I guess that makes more sense because, I don't know, there had been wars before, right? Like, Germany had already been through World War One, so it wasn't like if the war didn't go in their favor, something, you know, he would maybe still come out of it. But I guess once they began the Holocaust, it was sort of like, okay, this is, even if we lose the war, like, you know, we're going to be, you know, there's going to be consequences to this because it wasn't just a war.
That's true. And interestingly enough, it was his big mouth that prevented him from getting pardoned later in life, because keeping him prisoner was expensive. There was a 600-person prison with one prisoner.
Him.
Yeah, it apparently cost $50 million a year to keep him prisoner, which is insane. It originally had six prisoners, because the other high-level Nazis, but they all got released. He's the only one who got life sentence. And yeah, he would have gotten released eventually, too, for like mercy reasons. Yep. If he had not just been the most fervent Nazi while still in prison.
So what did they do in the end? They just left him in prison until he died?
Yes, but his death is a mysterious event. Because just as he was about to actually be finally released, and it's public knowledge that he was going to be released within a month, he got suicided under mysterious circumstances.
Oh.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting story.
Right. That's Hess.
Yeah, that's Hess. One last thing I want to say about Nazis and like trials is that a lot of top Nazis they tested everyone's IQs in the Nuremberg trials and I think later on in certain trials in Israel. Goering's was high. He was like 130 something. And there are a bunch
they
of other...
They were all high. There wasn't a single one under 115.
Except for Adolf Eichmann. Do you know who that is?
Eichmann was a genuine idiot. Yeah, that's true. But he wasn't in the Nuremberg trials. He was later in the 70s in Israel.
When they fished him out of Argentina, someone found him.
Below average intelligence, which is crazy, you know?
Yeah. So Adolf Eichmann, he was responsible for doing the logistics to the entirety of the Holocaust. So he was at the head of that. They executed him, right? In the end.
They did, yeah. It was actually very controversial at the time because Israel didn't really have a death penalty. And so it was the only person executed in Israel in since they abolished the death penalty, which was very early on, was Eichmann.
So well, people weren't happy with it?
Felt a bit like making an obsession from the laws.
Were people not happy with it, or when you say controversial?
Yeah, it felt as though it was, you know, a suspension of the law, not a suspension of justice necessarily, because no one disputed that he didn't deserve it. More of a suspension of law and order.
Mm. Interesting.
And,
also one more thing.
Apparently lots of Jewish religious leaders also wrote for him to get commuted to life sentence instead.
Interesting.
Which is interesting.
Yeah. Also, another thing, for Goering, his death sentence was death by hanging, not death by firing squad.
And it
was
something he actually knew from the moment the Nuremberg trial started that he was going to get killed. So he took the trial as an opportunity to just make himself look good. So it was not denying anything, just justifying it and making him sound like a hero. So, yes, I did all that. And that's why it was a cool thing to do. He was very disappointed though when he didn't get a firing squad, which is why he used the cyanide capsule, which apparently was in his face cream the whole time.
Face cream? Okay, all right. Well, that was
Hess. What kind of war criminal has face cream?
That was Hess. Now we'll move on to my thing, which is Roman triumphs.
Yes, go ahead.
So I don't think anyone knows exactly when the first triumph was, first Roman triumph, but it's said to have been Romulus. That he was the first ever Roman triumph. But I'll talk about what a Roman triumph actually is. So you had the Roman Empire, and you had military leaders, generals, etc., that after completing a very successful military campaign in, like, I don't know, Gaul or Spain, Africa, further east, so like around Israel, if you conquer territory, win a significant military victory, gain back territory. I don't know if gaining back territory counted.
It did. Even for Caesar, not losing territory got him a triumph.
Yeah.
Which was
so funny. The idea of triumphs is extremely like interesting and unique. It's more than a military parade. It's like joined together with religion and interesting customs, whereupon a general completes or does something extraordinary militarily, then his soldiers have to recognize him as imperator. So they declare him imperator. I don't know actually if it's every single soldier or if it's a certain rank. Soldier.
It's kind of like a big majority. If a lot of soldiers are screaming imperator, imperator, then that counts.
Okay, because I couldn't actually find any sources regarding that. But they get declared imperator by their army. And then what they do, at least in Republican Rome...
By the way,
Rome,
what does imperator mean? Do you know?
I actually don't. I just know it in this context.
It means victorious general.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Misha. And at least in Republican Rome, the way you got a triumph was you basically tell the Senate, like, hey, I would like a triumph. Triumph is essentially a massive military parade. That's the highest honor you could receive as a Roman citizen, like, ever. And it's not... Yeah, so you... Okay, I'll carry on with the Senate. So you ask the Senate for a triumph, and then the Senate votes on whether they give you the triumph or not. at which point you have to, I think, wait outside the walls of Rome with your army. And preparations start to get made. And I'm pretty sure the state pays for everything, where they set up a bunch of events for the Roman public. They organize a bunch of festivities, food, prepare religious sites for religioning. And then when the Senate grants the okay, then the Roman general with his army gets to do the very special thing that they bring arms within the city, within the walls of Rome, because you could not bear any arms in the city of Rome at all. And the triumph was the one occasion where you could officially and legally carry weapons around Rome, except for gladiator fights. But that doesn't count, really, I don't think.
Yeah, because they weren't considered soldiers necessarily.
Yeah.
And you want to get into the mythological reason for why the whole weapon rule existed.
I actually don't know where it comes from at all. Do you know?
It actually comes from Romulus and Remus, as you mentioned. So it's trying to justify that myth, because every Roman knows that fratricide is bad, but every Roman knows that Romulus is a hero. So how the hell do you combine those two ideas? Well, you say that Romulus built his city upon a hill, and that city had an imaginary boundary line around it. And Remus committed a crime deserving of death when he entered that line while having a sword on him. And that's why Romulus was justified in killing him. And that's why, as an extension of this, the city of Rome has that imaginary line around it that's marked with stones to signify where it is. And then
fun fact, you could only enter the city of Rome at certain designated checkpoints. So you couldn't just cross over the imaginary line, because then that's, I think, punishable by death. It was a pretty extreme punishment. Yeah, it was a really extreme punishment if you crossed illegally.
But what was the... So it was a line of rocks or some imaginary line that you couldn't see? Or what was the border?
It wasn't a real wall. It was rocks at certain intervals to show where the imaginary line was. But physically, anyone could cross it very easily.
Yeah. So going back to triumphs...
I had one question. So you said first the soldiers have to declare them saying imperator, imperator. But even once that's happened, you have to go ask for one.
You have to go ask the Senate. You have to go ask the Senate if you can.
Yeah, it's
get
kind of
triumph.
You use the first as a justification for the second. Okay. Hey guys, I was declared imperator. Care please. To give me a triumph, please?
Yeah. Okay. And because the state has to pay for all the festivities, the processions.
So is it a question of are you deserving or can we pay for it?
It's a question.
Or is it a bit of,
both? I think it's a question of are you deserving more, because the triumph combine. I'll get into this more, but the triumph combines elements of religion with a military victory. So, the triumph? Shut! I'm talking now. So the triumph was primarily about promoting the general. So it was a chance for the general to display himself as near divine. So when the army entered the walls of Rome, which they had to do through these checkpoints, there's a funny elephant story, which I'll get into later. So once the army enters Rome, the method of procession is that you have their captives and their spoils are the things that go first, followed by the army singing songs, mostly singing songs that... Don't even have to sing the praise of the general. They can actually be shitting on him. So in one of Caesar's triumphs, they're chanting this song, basically calling Caesar gay or something.
Was that an insult back then,
Not exactly. The insult wasn't that he's gay; it's that he is the passive partner. So they called him the whore of.
He's the sub, not the dom.
Yep.
He's the whore of who? The
Persian king. Oh, yeah. Technically the enemy, but he was stationed near Persia at the time and had a relationship with the king of Persia.
Yeah, so the army doesn't have to sing their praises or anything. Right. Or sometimes I guess they did.
Guard your sons and guard your daughters. Here comes the whore of Persia.
Yeah, that was the chant, which we funnily enough have in pretty accurate historical records, like documented. And the crowd is also cheering. And then I think at the very end you have the general. And the general is on a chariot, a four-horse chariot. And sometimes, okay, no, the base attire is purple toga, laurel crown, and the red face paint was optional. The red face paint essentially kind of, it's imitating Jupiter. This Jupiter's Jupiter's face is red. So you,
a specific statue of Jupiter that was made out of red marble.
Oh, okay. I didn't know a specific statue, but it's meant to signify that the general is a being of near divinity or near kingliness, because purple was the color of royalty, and the laurel crown. I don't actually know what the laurel crown signified.
What with the leaves or
whatever. That one. Mm-hmm.
I think it was victory, because it was the symbol of Victoria.
Okay, then. Yeah, and the triumph itself, the certain things that took place weren't set in stone. So one thing that was set in stone was visiting Jupiter's temple at the very end, I think, of either one at the very end of the procession of one of the days.
Triumphs are always one day. Caesar just managed to get three in a row.
Okay, right. So Caesar had three in a row because he somehow coped the Senate into giving him three.
Wait, but so three in a row would mean he enters, the whole thing happens, the next day they enter again.
Yeah.
So it's not that they stay in the city, it's just like repeat the process three times.
Mm-hmm, that's right. New spoils, new captives.
Oh, okay.
Funnily enough, big event is they strangle the captives in front of the audience.
Yeah, which is actually really barbaric for Romans because, they didn't enjoy gore that much, but for some reason, like public strangling of kings.
But
like,
then the Colosseum and gladiators, is that different or?
It was, I think as far as I'm aware, gladiators and like modern media are really like, over dramatized in their like brutality. Mm-hmm. So it was more of a, kind of halfway between that and like a sport league competition.
Oh, no? So it's like a gruesome mm-hmm. sport.
Kinda, right. Yeah.
There were essentially two things that modern media conflates. There were professional gladiators who were just athletes fighting to make it look cool and make it look fun. And then there were condemned criminals who often fought to the death against each other, against wild animals. That was a different thing.
Yeah.
And it's conflated.
But when you say that the professional gladiators, did they fight to kill, or was it just like we're fighting as a show of our strength, of our abilities?
Mm-hmm. The second one, yeah. Okay. It wasn't supposed to end even in serious injury because they were expensive.
Mm. Fun fact, actually, when Caesar was the thing, you know, the public guy who organizes events, not praetor, the one below that.
Not questor.
No. You know what I'm talking about.
I know
about.
What you mean. I can't remember the word. It's the guy who's in charge of celebrations.
Yeah, the, Aedile?
Aedile! Yeah, that's Aedile. Right, Aedile.
Yeah, so Caesar was an Aedile.
Fraser was Aedile.
And Aedile is basically a kind of like a political figure who organizes public events, takes care of bathhouses, takes care of the city, mm-hmm. mostly done out of his own pocket.
Oh, out of his own pocket.
Yeah, but
That's why they were always of very rich families.
But they can get sponsors and etc. But Caesar was an aedile, he actually organized an event so massive, where he brought in several hundred gladiators. And it got to a point where the Senate had to make a law that you can't have a certain number of you can't have beyond a certain number of gladiators because you basically mm-hmm. have like a tiny army within the city
that you control.
That yeah, oh. So mm-hmm. that you're paying
50 maximum. Yes. Which fun fact actually made killing Caesar harder later on?
Really?
The original idea was they were going to bring in gladiators and slaughter the guy. But they couldn't get enough.
Yeah, so back to triumphs. They liked public stranglings of captives, and it happened to Vercingetorix, right? If I remember correctly. Mm? It happened
Vercingetorix.
To
Vercingetorix, yeah, it did.
He was a...
Good job, I was going to say, but I couldn't remember his name.
Vercingetorix was a tribal leader of a united Gallic resistance during Caesar's campaign, and Caesar defeated him and then had him publicly strangled in one of his triumphs, which is pretty yikes, considering he's a king and everything.
Mm-hmm. In front of his daughters, mind you.
Oh, who really? Were,
Jesus.
Kept as Roman slaves.
Damn. So...
No chill.
Yeah, so the religious aspect, that's the dressing up in purple, red paint, laurel leaf, and then you go to the Temple of Jupiter, where you sacrifice, I think, traditionally, two... Not cows, but... God, not lambs.
Or ox.
Ox? Was it ox?
Oxen? I was going to say it's... I feel like it's ox, but I could be wrong.
I think some kind of
big animal.
Something like that. I think it was ox. Oxen. And then you have, like... Again, it varies, but... You can have all sorts of festivities planned for the Roman people, so it's something they enjoy as well. So while you're getting a chance to show yourself off, it's also like a public service thing to the people that, like, you guys were doing great. It's a big old military religious feel-good parade. That's the highest honor
you can get. Caesar actually gave each person in Rome a golden coin, causing mini inflation.
See, Caesar was mad loaded.
But so I wanted to ask, actually, how does being rich work then? Do you just have hoards of gold somewhere, or do you own stuff? Do you have sort of paper signed that you own this?
You had the treasury, but I think that was exclusively for the state. So
kind of, yeah. Essentially, the way you got rich is exclusively through military campaigns. Because if you try to get rich as a trader, you'd be said, okay, you're cheating somewhere there. How about we take half your stuff and you try again?
The government would do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
But essentially,
IRS.
The way you do it is either you go on campaign and you keep all the stuff for yourself, because the Roman government only wanted the land, essentially. All the other spoils of war you got to keep.
Okay. And the soldiers didn't get anything either. It was just the highest officer or general, whatever.
Oh, no. The soldiers got plenty. Like, after a successful campaign... they got either some money or a lot or an insane amount of money. So
or farmland.
Caesar, during the time of his triumphs, gave each of his soldiers a 10-year salary's worth bonus.
Yeah. Okay. So, but then it was still like a salary, like basically it was like a company, and then the CEO is the general and you have your employees, kind of. I'm just trying to link it to today's
kind of, yeah.
ideas of wealth and how to
CEO
make money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, because the soldiers are essentially wage workers who got a bonus after a campaign the generosity of the general. It wasn't
obligatory, but it was expensive. That makes sense. I can see the connection. And then you just own a lot of stuff, basically.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's not even that you own. It's that you get yourself appointed governor of a province for 10 years, and you just try to pump as much wealth out of it as possible in 10 years.
And also, the elephant... I'll finish the elephant story, then we'll move to Fraser's income things. So I don't know who, probably maybe Pompey's, maybe Scipio's, because Scipio did some stuff in Africa. That's what he's called.
If it's the story you're talking, I think you're talking about, it would be Pompey and the White Elephant.
Pompey, okay, sure. Pompey and the White Elephant, where in one of his triumphs, or his only triumph, I don't know how many he's had, he part of his procession was a big old elephant. And since, remember how I talked about the walls of Rome?
Yep.
And... You basically there's this massive arc of Titus. What was it?
I believe so.
Yes, I think it was through that. He couldn't take the elephant around the arch.
Mm-hmm.
He had to squeeze it through
because of this magical rules of
because of the rules. Okay. He had to squeeze the elephant through, and I think in the end he actually couldn't manage to squeeze the elephants through the arch.
So
he had to leave.
He went from sitting on an elephant to sitting on a mule
because they couldn't find a spare horse. Hell of a downgrade.
Yeah, so that's the funny elephant story. But that's how seriously they took the boundaries of the city.
Mm.
It wasn't a trivial thing.
Yeah. So,
yeah,
that was true. When you said Roman triumphs, I literally just thought, like, cool battles that they won in. Like, I wasn't aware that triumphs referred to a whole procedure of basically getting accredited with a win.
Talking about ancient Rome now, I really want to do future episodes on Rome more. Like,
oh yeah, we definitely should do episodes on Rome.
We should.
Like, we could do a whole Caligula episode because that guy was the most interesting character you'll ever hear about.
Mm. I recently found out about the Punic Wars, and they blew my mind. And Hannibal, who was, that blew my mind. And the Battle of Cannae being one of the bloodiest battles in human history.
If I remember correctly, I think in history we looked at it in year 7. And I think
really?
We did in my class. I don't remember anything about this. Yeah, we with Mr. Phillipson, I remember. And I specifically remember that they used the tactics from that in modern war. There was a guy talking about the Battle of Cannae, or however you pronounce it. I specifically remember that they used the same tactics in modern. I don't know which war. I don't know if it was for practice, whatever. But it was some video where he was talking about how they used the tactics today because it was such a genius move.
Damn. Oh, I didn't know
if I remember the name correctly. Wow. I'm pretty sure it was Cannae. Oh,
okay.
Interesting.
All right, well, Fraser, take the stand.
All right, so, I wanted to talk about nothing, not as specific as you guys, but, I was watching this BBC, podcast, I think, where they have a bunch of professors on a topic, and it was about the Incan Empire, which I don't actually know much about. I was pretty interested in it because my girlfriend's from Peru, and it was sort of, when you are learning about more international things, it was this huge... I think the biggest empire in the Southern Hemisphere in, all of history. And it was just basically a talk about some of the things that they had, like their religion, how did they become so successful? And then also, I didn't get to that part yet, but I know a bit about how they basically lost their power and their standing. So I don't know, but before the Incan Empire, there was, I forget the name, I think it was W something. I've never heard of it before, but apparently it was an empire before that had fell into ruin. And they somehow, they used that sort of history and that empire to build their own up. Because a lot of the reasons it was so successful is because they were instead of conquering in a way, I think maybe the Romans did something similar. They sort of joined with the other people.
Mm-hmm.
So they were sort of making deals, saying, if we, we're going to provide stuff if you give us your land and that you're going to join this empire. So that was one of the things that I think made them really successful. But they were also, I think... I don't know if it's considered engineering, but they were very good at sort of constructing, I think they were called terraces, because it's a very mountainous area. So the main, I think the heart of the empire was, I think, Cusco, and then obviously there's Machu Picchu and things like this, and they're built on mountains. So the idea that you build palaces is not possible. You can't build on mountains. So they had these, I think, terraces, which are just sort of, I guess, platforms going up the mountains, and that's how they lived. And one of the other cool things that they had, which I don't know, I guess they must have had in other empires as well, is they had the way of communicating. Because if you think about, if you have more and more land, how are you going to communicate? And I think some of the figures were they could get from Cusco to the sea, because I think it's kind of close, in a day. So they'd have these runners who would go, they would have towers along the way. They would have runners that run 5 kilometers, pass on a message, 5 kilometers, pass on a message. And I think it was really, at the time, it was a really efficient way to get around messages and sort of make sure they were keeping control of the land.
Late night messenger booty.
Oh, that's
call.
So cool.
Yeah, exactly. Spending a day to get there. And then it would get a week to get to, I think it was Guatemala or something like this.
Guatemala.
I'm not sure. It was one of the other South American countries. A different country completely.
Guatemala's. It's in the middle.
I can imagine that it's like a giant game of telephone. It gets distorted along the way.
Yeah, well, I actually don't know. They said that they had a way to write messages with rope. I didn't see. It was just through visual, so I didn't see a picture. But somehow, I think they physically handed a message on. I don't think it was verbal.
Ah, that's interesting. I actually read about this, that they had a writing system based on knots. So they had... three or four different kinds of knots and combinations of them make letters.
Yeah, I'm guessing that was it. And they just have, somehow they collect an entire message.
Could they
that.
Count the Incans?
I'm not sure. I'm sure they must have had some sense of... I looked at it in TOK. They must have had some sense of quantity, but I don't know how much they counted.
True. They had a fancy calendar, so they must have understood numbers somewhat.
I know that the first time that sort of finance, in a way, I guess, really developed numbers was via trading. I think in like England, when they were sending like ships out and they were making deals that people would invest, and I think that was when it was really like, also fractions were established because you owned like a portion of it. So I don't know if they had that level of like mathematical understanding, but they didn't. But what was also interesting was the religion side of things, because I've been thinking about this. They had a binary religion, which is actually not that like Judeo-Christian. It's unitary Judeo-Christian religions, because it's just one God in a way. Or sometimes, mm-hmm, I guess you could say there's sort of a Trinity as well. You know, the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit. There is sort of a threeness. But it's interesting that they had a binary sun and moon religion. So they worship the sun, which seems pretty logical, because at the time, you know, it provides a lot for you. If there's anything that's a god in a real sense, it's kind of the sun, because without it, we don't, you know, all our energy comes from the sun.
Yeah, I think we started with sun gods as humans.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, that was just sort of the logical, there's this thing in the sky that provides us with food and energy. But then also the moon. And one of the interesting things is that they had a lot of gold and silver. It was actually, I think, the biggest robbery in history was the amount of gold and silver that the Spanish conquistadors took back from South America.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. Historically, in terms of, I guess, accounted for inflation, whatever, it was a lot. But they didn't look at it in terms of monetary value. They said that to them it was a religious thing. So gold was, I think, like the tears of the sun. And silver was the same for the moon, something like this. It was a very sort of...
Wow.
Yeah, it was a pretty... They had a different relationship with the world around. Because another thing is... So there was obviously those precious metals were somewhat religious. Mm-hmm. But they also looked at land in an unusual way. They had this idea that when people die, they sort of go into the land in a way. So the way we talk about land... the way we talk about our ancestors, they would talk about sort of rocks and mountains and land and valleys and things like that. They had a very different relationship with the world around them. And apparently there is still this like rock that they thought had come from some god or something like that, that matches the mountain in the background. So this is really cool. I haven't seen a picture of it, but I'm guessing it's this cool image of a rock that's sort of molded to look like the mountain behind it. So yeah, the binary aspect was interesting, because I think that doesn't really come up in other religions, and a lot of things do seem binary.
It's pretty rare.
Yeah, I couldn't think of another example where there was this sort of two different important forces.
I mean, Zoroastrianism has that, but there one of the two is evil, and I'm guessing that's not the same for the Incas.
No, I didn't actually get... They didn't talk much about religion, but it came up quite a lot, and there was no mention of like a devil in a way. There was a mention of, apparently, there's this, like, the creation story of the land is that there's this family, and one of the brothers is like violent, and he's like bashing the mountains and creating the valleys with his weapons. So he almost seemed like, I guess, the evil, but there wasn't a mention of like fighting evil. It was just more a relationship with the land around you. And one other thing that they also mentioned is their relationship with the dead. So one of the things that they do is they sort of mummify, they sort of dry out their dead through different means, through sort of leaving them in towers for the wind to dry them out. And then they will bring them out and feed them and clothe them. And in some sense, they still believe that they were alive. So they said that apparently the dead would somehow they thought they talked or they communicated. I don't know how, but somehow the dead still had a say in the society. So they could like pick who the next. I think that the king there was called the Inca, like the leader. So they had a say, like the previous dead Inca had a say in who's the next one. Somehow they communicated. And it was like, yeah, they bring them out, they talk to them, they listen to them. And it was just this interesting idea of sort of, they don't see them as dead. And then once they sort of fade away, they fade into the land. So they become a part of the land. And then they talk about their ancestors as if they're somehow in the you know, rocks and mountains and whatever around them. So I didn't finish it yet. I would like to finish it. But it was just an interesting Because then obviously what happened later is the Spanish came, and I think one of the biggest things that messed them up was just sickness that they brought. Mm. Like they just didn't have, you know, it was basically a huge pandemic. They brought, I don't know what it was, but they brought smallpox. Is it smallpox possibly? I was thinking that.
Smallpox, I think it was. Yeah. Anthrax as well. Some other nasty stuff.
Yeah, they brought, and I don't know, I don't think it was on purpose. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it was just a mix.
No, it couldn't have been on purpose because no one understood disease back in the day.
Yeah, so they just brought it by chance.
Even if they wanted to.
Yeah, exactly. They brought it by chance. So, oh, and one other thing that's kind of messed up that I didn't know about, and neither did my girlfriend actually, is that whenever they changed Incas, so whenever they had a change of rule, they sacrificed a lot of children. Which you don't, you, there's a similar story in the Bible, obviously. I think with Abraham, right? With he's told by God, you have to sacrifice your kid. And right before he kills him, he says, okay, you've shown that you're loyal. Hmm. But they actually did, apparently that's what they think. They haven't found the bodies of these children, but apparently that's the thing, is that they basically said these children are like, they're pure, they're valuable, they're like our most valuable part of our society. And so we're giving them up to the gods. And it's, again, not something that you see a lot, because usually it's animals or your enemies. I think they said the Aztec Empire was all about sacrificing your enemies to your god.
That makes sense.
But for them, the most valuable thing was their children. So they would sacrifice like 200 children. Yeah. And I think it was also strangulation as well. Like they would take them up. Yeah, it seemed pretty gruesome. Oh, but to them it was, you know, there's a garden. When there were like droughts and then there were, you know, epidemics, or whenever there was something that meant all the gods are angry at us, they would say, okay, it's, we have to somehow appease them and sacrifice our children. So
I guess even if the ritual doesn't work, there are less mouths to feed. So yeah, by the way,
wins all around except for the child, I guess. But
true.
Yeah, it was interesting. Because it was, I think it was a very sort of developed, you know, economy and system and a system of rule. And they had a very, you know, good sense of, we make treaties, we make agreements. It wasn't a sort of, well, there was an aspect of, if you don't join us, we will just decimate you. Through some, they were also very militarily successful. But the sense I got is that they were pretty sort of, we're going to join together rather than we're going to take over and command you. And I guess that's why it was so successful. And then the Spanish came and stole a bunch of gold and silver and decimated the whole empire.
Interesting thing about the Spanish is that when they first came to South America is when they encountered platinum, because it doesn't really occur naturally to a significant degree in Europe. And originally they just throw it out to wherever.
We're thinking it was useless.
Because they called it unripe silver, because it's like silver but not silver, so it's fake silver.
Yeah, it's weird. But so funny. What actually caused them to take, I'm not sure what caused them to think that gold and silver are valuable. Was it just that it was rare, or it looked cool, or
looked like sun, looked like moon?
I mean, gold is an ideal currency material. It does not tarnish, does not deteriorate, cannot be easily counterfeited. It is
heavy,
generally believed. I mean, I don't know a single culture that thinks gold is ugly, so it's generally believed to be beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Heavy.
And as a side note, it's very, very easy to make coins out of. It's a soft metal, so it's easy to...
Okay, so it's almost like a practical sense. It wasn't... Because from the Incas' point of view, it was a sort of a religious... Because they said that for them, the pretty things were like to make stuff out of gold. Or silver or gems or something. And the Spaniards just melted all of that down. So they lost a lot of like jewelry, I guess. I don't know what you would call it, but sort of crafted precious metals. Because to them, that was the beauty and the prettiness, rather than just the gold, which represented this religious sort of, oh, it came from the sun and it's to do with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're saying that the gold themselves, itself without... crafting anything out of it wasn't particularly valued by them.
I don't know if it was
just a starting material.
It was more like a religious value. It wasn't like a, here's the gold, we're going to leave it there and we like it like this. So it's like, it represents the, I think it was tears of the sun, if I remember incorrectly. And then we're going to use that to make these pretty things as well, with other gems and stones and other things like that. And so the Spaniards, they came along, and we were like, we don't care about that. We just want the gold. So they just melted it all down and took the gold back with them.
Whack.
So, yeah, it's kind of... but it's interesting to think, because obviously now they speak Spanish and also Portuguese, but mainly Spanish in South America. And so it's interesting to see, because I'm not exactly sure. It happened a while. It happened a long time ago. But that sort of taking over of the land and, you know, leaving their language and things like that and their religion. I mean, I know that Peru is a very Catholic country now. It's completely shaped what the country is like now. Like, you know, it's a minority to speak. They still have a language that I think is like the traditional Peruvian. I think it's called Quechua. But it's just interesting to think that a lot of, like, it completely changed the course, like, of that area up until today, where they now speak a completely different language to what they had before, completely yeah. different religion. And I don't know of, I mean, I guess that's just colonialism in general.
If we ever do a colonialism episode, we really need to look at the conquistadors in South America versus the colonialization.
True.
Colonizing honestly, of America.
The conquistador of South America, we could easily do a Tea and Biscuits episode of, because it's really cool how the whole thing started. It was rather, sounds a bit like a sitcom, if I'm honest, that they came in there, they took the, I didn't know that that's his title, but apparently you say he's called the Inca. They took him hostage and just had him give orders for a couple months to make the Inca military useless, and then they started the actual conquest. So yeah, for a couple of months they were just sitting in the palace with the Inca, having him write the orders.
Yeah, it's what was interesting to me, and I think what's interesting in general in a big question in history is, why do these huge empires and power blocks fail, right? Like, what, they were so good, they were so developed, and then somehow something happens.
What do you mean, the Incan Empire?
Yeah, like the Incan Empire, the Roman Empire, other, you know, there was an empire before the Incan Empire that also failed. Like, all these power blocks that were so, they were so great, and then somehow, like, well, in this case, we know the Spanish came and they had, I don't know, they had guns at that point, I think.
They did, yeah.
Some level of, yeah, some level of shooting. And obviously they brought disease by accident, but it was just like, somehow that beat them, in that they were you know, a much bigger empire than the Spanish.
Yeah, it's weird.
I could be wrong, but I believe they didn't even have steel weapons, the Incas, before the Spanish
came.
The
only thing they mentioned was that they used, like, clubs, I think, sort of hitting instead of stabbing, I think.
Yeah, I'll be honest, a lot of differences between the South American tribes kind of mixed in my head, but I think it might have been the Incas who actually put chipped obsidian into their clubs to make it more deadly.
Possibly. The only thing, maybe, because what they mentioned on this podcast is that they had a particularly effective way of fighting as well. So it wasn't just, oh, we're going to make a deal. It was also, you know, if you don't, we will still beat you in combat. And somehow they were able to back that up, I guess, with some development in their weapons, because it was apparently about sort of just bashing people around with these bats. Instead of, I don't know, swords. Because they didn't have horses either. I mean, one of the other interesting things is, how do you get around, how do you transport your stuff around?
Llamas.
Yeah, and they had llamas and alpacas, and they didn't ride them. So it wasn't like, you know, you wouldn't sit on it. You would just put, like, I don't know, I guess bags or some sort of carrying method, and put your potatoes and maize and things like that in it. And then that's how you get around.
Yeah, apparently when they first saw horses, they called them six dogs, because they were four-legged mammals with fur that were six times bigger than dogs.
Yeah, they would just, I don't know, they just had a completely different way of also just expanding, because you couldn't expand in the normal sense because you were on a mountain. So one of the things that they said is that a lot of the farming was sort of vertical. So they knew at different, they had these microclimates, and they knew at different levels they could plant different things. And I heard that apparently at different levels you have different colors of potato. They have, like, a maize. They have different things that they can, you know, they have alpaca farms, llama farms, and they were aware of all of these microclimates, where they were like, okay, this is the climate where we grow this particular vegetable or this particular, you know, we can keep this particular animal. Because it was, I think, the capital was, I think, like 3,000 meters above sea level. Very high up, I think. So, yeah, it was just, it was interesting to see that it was a very different culture. And it was very successful. And then, yeah, it didn't stand against the Spanish. But I'll finish it. I'm interested to see what else they mention in it.
Okay. I don't have anything to add.
Yeah, it was more like, I think you guys are more a specific example in history. I was just a general thing that I just have been looking more into now. A new sort of interest, I guess. Yeah,
Incas are interesting. They're a pretty underrated civilization.
Yeah, yeah, it is pretty cool. Interestingly enough, when you mentioned the courier system of a whole bunch of people with short laps, that's similar to what the French had in the 18th century.
Mm.
They would have postal carriages, which changed horses every 7 miles.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, I guess because they were running, these guys, I think. They didn't have, everything was by foot, so I guess they had to do shorter distances. But yeah, to me also, it's not just the whole sort of continent. It's interesting because there are some parallels, not really, but because they all speak essentially the same language, there's a much more connected feel to that part of the world, I think, that continent. Well, if you look at, for example, Europe, I mean, think about, you know, there have been two world wars, a cold war, like it's been torn apart. And I sometimes think, why is that? You know, is it, and I'm sure there are still differences in South America, but is it just because, you know, they speak the same language, or is there something, some historical factor that has meant that they've been a bit more cohesive, I would say, from my point of view, from what I've seen.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't peaceful by any stretch of the imagination, but compared to Europe, I mean, it had to be by default.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't sort of, you know, love and happiness all the time. But maybe only today, nowadays, it just feels like there's more of a connection between them. And it's been interesting to see because, you know, when you meet someone from Europe, they could be completely different. You know, like a Polish person has no connection with, I don't know, a Spanish person, for example. It's completely different. And yet in South America, you know, a Peruvian and a Argentinian will speak and they'll get along and they'll feel more connected. And I don't know, it's just interesting to look into that part of the world, that history of that area.
Definitely. Yeah. Okay. This was a fun episode. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, guys. It was very fun.
You spoke very well.
Yeah, first episode, it's a bit stressful, but...
You did very well because our first ever recording... It took us a while to get into
it.
To find our voice. And then, like, even in later episodes, we just, like, slowly developed a confidence. And it took, like, in the beginning, we were both really awkward. And then it just gradually got better. So, props, bro.
Thanks. Well, it was fun being on. I was obviously a bit stressed, but it was... I like these chill episodes. They're nice to just sort of chat about something that... Because I didn't know about either of Hess or these triumphs. So it was... new knowledge has been acquired, for sure.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you for listening to another episode of... Well, Tea and Biscuits, not Promethean Onion. That's the main series. Thank you, Fraser, for coming on.
No, it's my pleasure.
And yeah, we'll see you next week. Or I actually don't know what... how our upload schedule is right now, but I think next week, we're going to record again.
So. Yes, this will either come out before the Promethean Onion episode we recorded or after. It's to be determined.
Okay.
Probably after.
Regardless, thank you for listening and have a good whatevsies. I don't know.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Have a good end of winter / beginning of spring.
Oh, yes. Finally.
Fun. Finally.
Finally, sun. Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.